I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Every morning, we awake to a world marvelously alive. Where do we encounter awe and wonder in this world? In animals and plants, in deserts on mountains, in forests, ocean, and sky, in history, art, and science, in human striving and human kindness. Join us as we quest for the awe and wonder of knowing we are part of something infinitely larger than ourselves. They seem to pop up out of nowhere, then feed for only a few days on damp, decaying twigs and barks and branches, garden compost, before disappearing from view. But this is only their most visible stage of existence. Maybe they're just lurking out there somewhere. Frequently mistaken for fungus, they're actually something else altogether, but neither plant nor animal. The ones that sometimes show up in my yard tend to be bright yellow, although where I live, they don't seem to be very common at all. Now, I've heard lots of stories about them, but this is, hands down, my favorite about organisms called slime mold.
We actually met in a tree class that he was teaching, and I thought he was an incredibly handsome man, to put it lightly, who knew, again, the secrets of the world that I wanted to know. And I was peppering him with questions, so many questions about trees and the world and everything, which is my, of course, method of flirting. And then one day in class, he brings me a slime mold and is like, "Here, I thought you'd enjoy this." And I was like, "I'm marrying this man. This is it. This is it. I'm going to marry this guy."
Romance can be sparked in any number of ways, but now you can add slime mold to your list. Rebecca McMacken, lead horticulturist for the American Horticultural Society, is our guest today. In recent years, she has become a preeminent ecological horticulturist and served for over a decade as Brooklyn Bridge Park's Director of Horticulture. Part of our conversation will touch on this beloved public park in New York City, built on reclaimed acreage that previously had been an industrial waterfront. Our main focus, though, will be to get to know about the passion Rebecca has for the kind of gardening she does. Ecological horticulture, an activity that's really a lived way of understanding the dynamic world of organic interaction and interdependence. I don't know that I have met a more committed proponent of our need to do right by the spaces that we call our yards or gardens in order to keep all life thriving. Rebecca has what for me is an infectious love of nature and derives a sense of constant wonder through her care for life forms, large or small, familiar or rare, beautiful. Well, who cares about traditional notions of beauty if you're somebody who can get swept off your feet by a man who brings you slime mold? Well, okay, at least you did call him handsome. When Rebecca McMacken first experienced what I'm going to call a conversion that left her fixated on the various inhabitants of our biosphere, well, this happened because of something much larger than that simple gift of slime mold. It was actually a southern magnolia tree. In some instances, this organism can grow to be over 100 feet tall, and that would be impressive enough were it not for what actually caught her eye first, and that was enormous creamy white flowers, each bearing from 6 to 12 petals.
It's like a foot across, and the smell is lemon and honey. It just seems unreal, like something you'd expect to see in the tropics or on a cartoon of like flowers on the moon. It's so big and gorgeous, but it's here. It's in the eastern United States, and it's very special to me because it is also the flower that convinced me that I was meant to study horticulture and garden and learn stories of the plants that I grew up around and the plants of the land where I was born.
How does this magnolia talk to you and persuade you?
So I was an academic. I was doing a master's degree in freshwater ecology in British Columbia. And I had fallen in with a bunch of botanists, and they were fascinating, wonderful people. But I was convinced that freshwater ecology was fascinating and freshwater policy was the future. But I really started recognizing that people around me understood the world in a way that I really cherished. And I wished that I understood the world in that way too. And one day I was in front of the biology lab with my friend Allie, who was an ichthyologist. She studied fish. And we were looking at these massive white flowers. They were just humongous. And I was remarking about how gorgeous they were. And Allie just says, "Oh, that's Magnolia grandiflora. It's native to your part of the world." And I had never heard anything so marvelous in my entire life. I felt like she was reciting an incantation, and that this was like almost like the fact that plants had these beautiful, magical names that were almost like a secret. Like if you knew them, the scientific, the Latin names of plants were like this cool secret code name. And that this gorgeous, the prettiest flower I'd ever seen is actually from where I was from. That to me was marvelous and incredible. And I suddenly understood that these plants had stories and that I wanted to know those stories. I was greedy. I was like a dragon for plant stories, and I wanted them so badly. And then I wanted to be the person to be able to tell those stories to other people and to share that out in the world.
That fairly lush description you just gave us for this species of magnolia, well, I could easily stereotype you as somebody, you know, who gets suckered in by the glossy garden pictures. I'm thinking about the ones I used to see when I was a kid in Better Homes and Gardens magazine, for instance. But I don't think that's really you. So I'm going to reach into my sleeve now for a little question, a trick. It might help Rebecca McMacken show how you're not so conventional, so traditional with your garden aesthetic. How do you feel about those upright tree corpses called snags?
Tree corpses. All right. So a snag is an upright tree corpse. It is the leftover trunk of a tree after that tree has perished. And while those snags are often disappeared from the landscape, the moment trees start to decline in the United States, we just yank them out of the landscape like they were never there. The reality is that those snags are incredibly important ecologically. If you imagine a forest, you imagine how often trees die. And how often snags are just part of those natural systems. Of course, it makes sense that so many thousands and thousands of species of insects and fungi, birds, have all evolved to use those snags and make them their home.
Ecological horticulture, Rebecca's field of expertise, is an approach to landscape management that tries to do more than just select, arrange, and maintain plants as mere ornamentation in gardens or open spaces. Imagine the opposite of a formal planting or the contrived geometries of Versailles or some other palatial garden. Instead of these obsessively controlled works of art, and I will not deny that they are stunningly artistic, well, instead, think of humans approaching landscape in a minimally invasive way, leaving nature significantly more free. A multiplicity of life forms, unpredictable, less controlled by us, but more at liberty to do their own thing. Sometimes they'll behave amicably in concert with each other, sometimes acting in fierce competition. Well, the basic aim of an ecological horticulturist is to lean into natural, biological, and systemic relationships. Less domination, less artificial manipulation. Historically speaking, human gardening schemes and landscape interventions have often inflicted unintentional but unmistakable environmental harm. What Rebecca and others like her do is not rewilding per se, and certainly not an abdication of all management practices, but the gardens she tends will probably strike you as messier than your grandmother's bed of marigolds or petunias or zinnias, with Dusty Miller thrown in there, of course. Highly coddled, dead-headed, raked, manicured, nothing left by grandma to die or rot, few places actually that are attractive to birds or insects, and certainly no slime molds or snags are invited. Traditional gardens have mostly flouted the nature and the serendipity of organisms that spring up of their own devices on their own schedules, well, you know, like nature. Now, everything I've said in trying to define ecological horticulture is an apt introduction to what you would find going on today at Brooklyn Bridge Park in New York City, where Rebecca McMacken was director of horticulture.
Brooklyn Bridge Park is an 85-acre post-industrial public park, which means that there was industrial infrastructure, in this case shipping piers in New York City, that were reclaimed and turned into green space for the community, for everybody, for tourists, for wildlife. They took these huge shipping piers, a mile and a half of shipping piers in downtown Brooklyn, on the coast between Brooklyn and downtown Manhattan. As you can imagine, a shipping pier is just like a big slab of concrete out over the water. And on top of them, they built hills and forests and meadows and playgrounds and basketball courts, all different kinds of public amenities. That process started many decades ago, but it took about 11 years to build the park properly. And I was director of horticulture there for that time. My job was to oversee horticultural construction, but also to care for the land, to take care of this new, really constructed ecological system.
Was it kind of like a blank canvas that you got to paint on, or had somebody already put some brushes on it?
So the park was designed by Michael von Valkenburg and Associates. They're a landscape architecture firm who specializes in post-industrial landscape architecture. And they've made many ecological projects in the past, but this one was really the result also of a lot of community advocacy. The people in that region really wanted a park that wasn't just lawns and trees. They wanted a park that welcomed New Yorkers across the animal kingdom as well. And so the park ended up having salt marshes and freshwater wetlands and all of these ecological systems. And the goal was not only to make it a place for millions and millions of people, but also a place that migratory birds and rare bees and butterflies could actually use as land and use as habitat. And then that's really the beauty of that project to me, is not so much that it's so successful with people or so successful as wildlife, but the integration of those two things. It's a place where millions of people and flocks of birds and huge populations of butterflies can all commingle and get to know each other. It's really a very New York story.
So you got to set the table and invite the guests to dinner.
I mean, so the Michael von Valkenburg and Associates, they're the designers, right? So they designed the first wave of the plant palettes and the various ecosystems of the park. And what they did, so for a lot of the park, they planted a lot of tiny baby trees and then a bunch of sun-loving perennials underneath them. And as those trees grew up and got bigger and bigger, they shaded out all of the plants underneath them. And so it was our job on the horticulture team to replant pretty much the entire understory of the entire park and figure out what plants work in those environments. And so it was just an absolute joy to do that work. And we worked with bird people, we worked with bee people, we worked with plant people, people who were ecologists, to really think about what are the groups of animals and the groups of plants that will use this land, want to live in New York City, but can't because they don't have a place. And we researched and tried to create space for those communities in the park, while also making it incredibly beautiful and functional for people.
It seems to me that I cannot describe this park as a place that creatures, animals, living things, plants, that they came back to, because they weren't there from the beginning. If it's on piers, that's all man-made built environment there. What do you call this return of life to a place where it wasn't?
Yeah, we should come up with a name. We should come up with a cute name for this sort of work, because it really was incredible. You know, the park wasn't just built on concrete out over the water. It had this giant highway running right alongside the land side of the park, and that cut it off from the rest of Long Island, from the rest of Brooklyn. And so an animal like a snake or a turtle or a frog had to get into the park somehow, either on like over the street, or sometimes eggs would come in on the feet of birds. But it really took like 5 years for a lot of these animals just to start showing up into the park. It's totally incredible. But they find it, right? I think that the most important thing that we can all do is protect ecosystems that are functional right now and that require our protection. There's a lot of ecological destruction happening and we need to protect those. But also it's incredibly important to recognize that where we need to, we can also retrofit these ecosystems into cities that have already been built and don't have the ecological diversity that is healthy for wildlife and healthy for people.
When Rebecca McMacken introduces or reintroduces or even just coaxes living organisms back to compromised or degraded places, potential homes where ferns, mosses, grasses, sedges, flowers, insects, mammals, birds, snakes, frogs, you name it, can thrive. Well, she's aiming to make these places not just more biodiverse and bioabundant, but more bioreceptive. Now, that's a word I learned here on Constant Wonder during a conversation with Adam Nicholson. Nicholson happens to be the grandson of the British couple who established the famous Sissinghurst Garden in England, which, by the way, is a very tightly designed and controlled space. You should hear Nicholson describing how he himself built tide pools on the coast of Scotland in a spot where previously there had been no tide pools, and by golly, if sea creatures didn't show up to live in them. It's another great nature story along the lines of, if you build it, they will come. Check out our Season 2, Episode 23, or read Nicholson's book. It's titled Life Between the Tides. Parenthetically, his tiny tide pools were nowhere near the 85 acres at Brooklyn Bridge Park, but the principle is the same. Sticking here now with Rebecca McMacken on this side of the Atlantic, we're going to turn next to her early backstory of becoming a person who sets about setting the stage for life to thrive. What kinds of experiences and formative events in childhood shaped her, and what led her in adulthood that would make her a preeminent voice for greater ecological sanity in the gardening world? Well, it turns out she has a few stories that are going to put a broad smile on your face, especially if you were fortunate enough to be a free-range kid when you were young. Well, I remember endless, carefree days spent just poking around outdoors to see things with wings or antenna or roots or seeds. And maybe you were just as lucky too. I'm Marcus Smith, and you're listening to Constant Wonder. I've worked with lots of younger kids, including my own, and I know firsthand the great feeling of finding just the right kind of educational listening for younger folk. We've got a podcast perfectly suited for younger hearts and minds. It's the Constant Wonder Kids podcast. Stories from the original Constant Wonder podcast featured in a way that's totally accessible for children from about kindergarten age until they hit middle school. Many of these episodes are adventure stories out in nature with fascinating people who go out into the wide world to see its wonder and awe. Curious, developing kids love this podcast, as well as the grown-ups who guide and love these kids. True stories about ocean divers, bird scientists, volcanologists, non-experts who rescue animals and rewild and replant damaged habitats. Positive stories about people doing positive things for the world. Would you like to get inside the mind of a bee, or find tiny hummingbird eggs, or go in search of seahorses? Maybe discover amazing ways that some plants can think and communicate. Constant Wonder Kids is perfect for road trips, bedtime listening, maybe just for whenever your brain's got an itch that needs to be scratched. New episodes drop on Mondays. Tune in to Constant Wonder Kids on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to Constant Wonder. In the birding community, people are frequently given to talking about their spark bird. The lights go on, the magic starts, they start hearing angels, you know. How young were you when you first started hearing those gardening plant angels?
I grew up on a small farm in rural New England, and I grew up pretty feral. And I had a level of freedom as a kid that as a mother now, I'm just absolutely terrified by it. But I'm also really grateful for it because due to many very dramatic and many very ordinary conditions, I've always had trouble understanding other humans. And I grew up fairly isolated from them. And I think that because of that isolation, I had no one to teach me that I was above or even separate from the tiny animals that were all around me. And I was able to form real relationships with moles and recognize trees as like these amazing guys who were in my life.
Oh, what age are we talking about here when you're hanging out with a mole?
I mean, I would say my mom likes to tell this story when I was about 5 or 6 and I was down by our pond and I had been chasing moles around. We had this beautiful lawn that moles would tunnel up through and I found this little mole and I was wearing a skirt and I kept on trying to get the mole to go into my skirt and I was chasing the mole around the lawn and I would lay my skirt down on the ground and then sort of try to like shovel the mole into the skirt. And the mole was not having it. Like absolutely miserable. So eventually I very lovingly picked up the mole in my little hands and the mole bit me. And I was so sad. I was, of course, like a little bit hurt, but mostly just heartbroken. And I went crying to my mom and was like, "Mom, couldn't he see that I loved him?" And she is constantly telling the story as like my origin story, like what, like how I'm interacting with the world. So definitely by the time I was 5, I was out in the world with no supervision whatsoever. And, you know, I remember by the time I was 10, being able to just go into the woods and hang out and it wasn't a big deal. I didn't even need to tell people where I was going. It was just really out there. And it was so incredibly valuable. It was so important, even though it, in some ways, again, as a mom, I'm like, yikes. I'm just so grateful for it because I think that if I could just zoom out for a moment, I think that that recognition of plants and animals as beings with integrity and friends, characters in our lives, that recognition is not something that everybody has. It's not something everybody gets. Oftentimes, when people look around at the world, they see a bunch of resources to be used. Even sometimes people are seen as other resources to be used. But I don't think that kids are born with that. I actually think that that is a worldview that needs to be constructed and defended, and a lot of effort goes into keeping people alienated from their environments, from the natural world, and from each other. And so to grow up without that instruction was really a huge gift. And I see my job as helping pass that along. It wasn't just that I was like, you know, outside by myself all day. My parents were hippies, and we had like one pig and one cow and a bunch of chickens. And my first garden was when I was 6 years old and my mom had me grow carrots. I got to pick to grow carrots myself and I loved them. They were very darling. And one of my earliest memories was sitting in the field with my mom. And it had this sort of dreamlike quality where the sun is really sparkly and, you know, it's backlit and my mom's hair is black and flowing beautifully. And she is picking a buttercup flower, these really sparkly, beautiful flowers in the field. And she's holding it under my chin. And she's telling me that this is how she can tell that I like butter, that she sees the yellow reflection on my chin. And then I remember taking the buttercup and then holding it under her chin and being able to tell her she liked butter. And it was like magic, right? To see, I was like, oh my gosh, this is a truth-telling flower. This is like absolutely marvelous. And so of course I went around and I tested everybody I knew and I shared this incredible ability with as many people as I could. And when I think back about the ways, again, that I formed those really important and life-saving relationships with the natural world, it was through stories when I was little and through, they were either myths or uses, which plants I could eat, which plants I could make a bandage out of. Cool features, gross features, a big fan of gross things.
For example?
So many in the natural world. Are you familiar with the flower of skunk cabbage?
We have a Western skunk cabbage. I don't know if it's the same. Out in the wild under the aspen trees.
Yeah, yeah. If you imagine that flower, so what it is early in the spring around here, and I'm sure that your skunk cabbage is very similar. There is this brown sort of flame-shaped flower very close to the ground. And out here where we get snow, the snow will melt around that skunk cabbage. It's actually a flower that emits heat. The long, strong root system of the skunk cabbage will metabolize starches so that that flower can emit heat and waft the most putrid smell you have ever smelled in your entire life out into its environment in order to attract the carrion beetles and bottle flies and other types of flies and beetles that pollinate that flower. The flower is a mimic. It's red and it's stinky, and it is a mimic for rotting meat. And all of the animals that use rotting meat in their reproduction cycle are attracted to this flower early in the spring and will go and will pollinate it. And so, you know, a lot of people think of flowers as pretty and sweet and lovely, but there's also very dark and dingy sides of flowers as well.
So you won't dodge the skunk flower? You actually take some delight in
one of those? Yes. And I think that that's important, right? Especially when you're trying to attract children to these stories. A lot of the stories that I learned when I was little were stories of plants that were from Europe that were introduced. And as a person with ancestors who are also from Europe, it made sense. And I'm living on land that has been colonized for hundreds of years. It made sense that those were the plants that I learned when I was little, that that was that culture. But as someone who cares deeply about ecological relationships and ecological communities, I spend a lot of time also trying to learn and share the stories of the plants that evolved here, that are native plants, that have these relationships, that have survived hundreds of years of ecological devastation. And skunk cabbage is one of them. So when you learn these stories and try to pass them along into the culture, the way that you know that you've succeeded is when they ripple out. When a child will share that story with another child, that's real success. And then those relationships are part of the culture then.
Let's bounce back to gross slime mold. Everybody else around me calls it dog puke, and they don't even know what it is. Well, we've heard how you fell in love, at least in part because of your husband to be, who brought you the specimen of that stuff. Do you really, truly have any kind of affection for it? And Rebecca, let me be absolutely clear here. I'm only pursuing this line of questioning because traditional gardening is still mainly seen as pursuing beauty. Those are my air quotes. Some sort of old-fashioned stereotype about what's beautiful, and you seem to be bucking that tradition.
If you were going to land on another planet and look for life and you found slime mold, you'd just be like, yes, this tracks. This makes perfect sense.
I've heard of some crazy experiments in which these slime molds have an ability to go prowling for food.
There's an inherent intelligence to slime mold where they put food on one side and food on the other side and put slime mold in the middle. And it's created these incredibly efficient pathways through mazes. They started giving them harder and harder tests where they would take a map of a city and they would put little pieces of food in places where they wanted a transit hub, for example. And then they would put the slime mold in, and the slime mold would come up with a sort of public transportation network that you do see in cities, that the slime molds would map them onto cities as well.
Intelligent, but not visually attractive?
So the slime mold that my husband presented to me, I don't know the species. There's many, many species of slime mold, but this one was fluorescent yellow and literally just looks like a bunch of slime, like smeared on a piece of bark. It's shiny, it's slippery. And when you look really closely, it's actually an amalgamation of millions and millions of individual little organisms that can all work together, sort of like a man-o-war jellyfish. They can all organize together for reproduction and food, digestion, et cetera. But really, they're all a bunch of little individuals. This one looked slimy, but there are some that have absolutely beautiful structures that look like little balloons or hot dogs or powder. Or, as you mentioned, dog vomit. There is a dog vomit slime mold out there. Yes, absolutely. If he was like, this is disgusting and I thought you'd like it, I would have been like, you know me, you get me.
So you have described some memorable childhood scenes, lots of time outdoors, cuddly little moles, watch out for those teeth, a lot of organic opportunity for you to get to know the world. So now I want to get into subsequent years. You're older, there's a beginning of a trajectory that's going to lead to you becoming a horticulturist. And this path was not, as I understand things, it was not a straight path for you.
I got out of rural New England the moment I could drive. I was a pretty wild teenager, and I went to New York City, and I didn't think at all about trees. I spent about a decade of my life just on roller skates, at dance clubs, working in art and fashion and drag, and having a lot of fun. But again, as a mom, I'm like, yikes, this was maybe not the safest environment for a teenager, but again, lots and lots of fun. And so I was just living, you know, a exciting city life, but there was always something really missing there. And I felt, again, just like a pervasive loneliness and alienation from my environment.
Just a moment, because
sure.
If you felt this alienation, you would not have put it in those words at that time, I don't think.
No. I think it was teen angst, right? I think I was just an angry kid in many ways, and didn't understand people, didn't understand politics. I was mad at a world that would treat children and countries and I saw the harmful elements of the modern world, and I didn't feel like I had a method to effectively change them. And so I started protesting, started working with various protest groups, and it was very energetic and wonderful, and I was often angry. I was often just amped and in a negative space. And what I would do in that time when I really needed a break, I would go to plant stores. And in Chinatown, or aquarium stores, and I would just sort of bathe in the chlorophyll, and I noticed that they just grounded me. That being around plants in that moment really grounded me.
Rebecca did her very best to put her angsty teenage temperament behind her. She got serious about an education, never abandoned her sense of wanting to help bring about greater good, greater justice for society. But after an initial foray in her undergraduate studies into political science, she ended up leaving New York City and headed out to British Columbia to pursue a master's degree. And I told you this is not going to be a straight path. Somehow, she started studying freshwater biology. That's a shift of gears.
I was in Victoria.
A big, famous botanical garden there, of course.
Yes, big gardening culture. And it was wonderful. It was a joy to go out there. I drove all the way across the entire country, and I got there and was amazed at the health of that ecosystem. To be with fresh air and green plants and a salmon run just a half hour outside of the city. I had never lived in a ecologically intact system before. And so that was a real revelation. Again, I started thinking that I was just going to study freshwater policy. I was a wonk. I liked politics, and I still do, but it's not what I'm really driven towards. But I thought that that's where I could be most helpful, was in making regulations for freshwater systems. But in order to work on that policy, I had to take a bunch of classes in ecology and just the basics, you know, basic botany, basic how lakes work, how forests work, how earth works, all of that stuff. And I just kept on going in that direction, falling in love with the world around me.
I'm going to hazard an interpretation of your life to this point as you've described it to me. It sounds like you began with a focus on things like, here's a mole, here's a buttercup, here's a skunk cabbage. And even as much as you can love those things, or even slime mold, those are discrete, separate entities. And here you are suddenly piecing it all together like a giant web, and you're seeing the interrelationships. And that, I don't think it supersedes your love for individual life forms, but something happens there that I think is really big.
Absolutely. You're so right. It's about relationships and about communities as opposed to individuals. growing up in the culture that I grew up in, there was so much emphasis on individual selves and individual well-being rather than thinking about communities. And it was through ecology, which is the study of communities, really, that I was able to see systems functioning for what they were. And that in order to support individuals, in order to support ourselves, that it really was the support of systems.
Well, give me a specific example with one of those aha moments where rather than, oh, this is theoretically making sense, where you felt something about the beauty of a system that you were studying now that you were into this discipline of ecology.
Yeah. When I got to British Columbia, I fell in with a bunch of like real hippies. The East Coast has nothing on British Columbia hippies. These people were like in a commune. They were raising and slaughtering ducks. We went for a month in the winter with no hot water, just like ideologically to like not have hot water in the winter. And so I moved in with them and had a great time. And they would do things like support tree sits, where there's this amazing old growth forest in British Columbia that was being chopped down for 2x4s and toilet paper, just the horrors of these massive centuries old trees getting cut down. These people would go out and they would support the networks of people trying to like put their bodies on the line to stop those forests from being destroyed. And so we went on this camping trip out into the Walbran, into this forest, into the middle of a forest with people who lived in the forest. Like there were people who had been there for years, again, trying to stop these trees from getting chopped down. There was one guy who was a chemistry professor. There was one guy who was a self-proclaimed ninja. He had studied ninjutsu and that was his whole thing. And he was just like this ninja of the forest. Amazing characters, and we're camping out there for about a week or so. Growing up in Connecticut in the woods, it's a very different experience. In Connecticut, the woods have been chopped down a few times at the very least. Many of the animals that were on this land hundreds of years ago are no longer on the land. Whereas out there, like this is old growth forest, these trees had never been chopped down. There were grizzly bears around us. There were salmon runs. There were bald eagles everywhere. To see that, to see what it looked like, and to be within it, what it feels like to be in those environments, and to understand that the land where I grew up had been like that at some point. And I have no idea what that was like. And of course, the goal is never to turn back the clock, but our goal could be to create a flourishing future that has some of those same feelings.
With what Rebecca said right there, well, that's given me a sense. It's actually a great glimpse into where her heart really lies. With that mention of hers, the goal of creating a flourishing future, who wouldn't adore that notion? And that it's somehow connected, that here in the present, we might be able to connect with feelings, as she puts it, that a landscape may have had in bygone years of the distant past. I'm getting this image of healthy, organic continuity over time of living things working as community. I think this is the perfect time for me to bring in the fact that Rebecca McMacken today has a role in helping direct the care of the famous Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx. Woodlawn Cemetery is one of the largest cemeteries of New York City, and it also has the distinction of being a National Historic Landmark, the first burials there having taken place during the Civil War.
Cemeteries are some of the most wonderful landscapes in the world because they're the site of a confluence of a great cultural history, a sacredness even, and then often botanical and environmental context that you can't find outside of cemeteries. And that's because of disturbance. In a city, the land is constantly disturbed. It's called a disturbance regime in ecology. You can find a tree in New York City that is 100 years old, 200 years old, maybe there's a couple of trees that old. But it's very rare that there's a piece of land where trees don't get killed and chopped down and a house is built, a road is built over and over and over and over again. Cemeteries are some of the only places where trees and land are allowed to just exist through the centuries right? That's really what a cemetery is a promise to maintain a memory through time and into the future of people and groups and movements. And often they do the same for plants as well.
Here are a few words you've written about this cemetery. The ecological benefit of big trees entirely dwarfs that of young trees. Some of these trees are over 300 years old. They are absolute monsters. I feel like when I visit them, I should leave an offering. They are so beautiful. I feel like asking, what do you need? How can I take care of you? This impulse to care for something like an old tree, did that impulse originate when you were there with the hippies in British Columbia? Can you pinpoint when that began, or is it kind of fuzzy?
I mean, I think that I've been a person who wants to be helpful. I'm someone who likes to feel like I have a purpose in the world. And so even with that little mole that I was trying to hold, I was still like, I was trying in my misguided way to take care of it. But I do think that when you're around organisms that really dwarf you and fill you with awe, it's such a relief. It is such a relief not to be the biggest thing in the room and not to be the one in charge. Rather than looking at a tree that's hundreds of years old and thinking, all right, you know, I'm going to manage this tree, right? That relationship to me is unfortunate. Sometimes it's necessary, but to me, it's unfortunate. To be around a tree that old and to just bask in its grandeur. Think about the things that tree has seen. Many of the trees at Woodlawn Cemetery, they were around before the state of America was created. You know, to think of the history that they have seen is really just absolutely marvelous. And so, of course, we're there to support them in whatever they need and just, you know, to carry on and live their best lives.
Do you make appointments with trees, or do you just happen to one day brush up against the opportunity to see one?
I mean, I'll go after trees. I'm a big tree hunter. And when I do notice a good tree, I will spend some time with it. There is a tulip tree outside of my office window that I'm looking at right now. It's big. I love this tree so much. It's one of my favorite trees in the whole world. It's probably 24 inches across and maybe 50 to 60 feet tall. And they're tall and they're straight and thick like a tulip tree is. And I find it really grounding to go out and be around this tree or to look at this tree and just to recognize the energy that tree has and be grateful for it. I gain a lot from that experience, and I try not to take it for granted.
Yeah. Well, I'm totally with you, but I do want to introduce something that is a certain tension that I don't believe that wonder and awe are without tension. I think oftentimes wonder and awe will introduce tension into our lives because something is hard to understand or comprehend, or because we might have an ethical obligation to do something. It's not the end of the story. So many people tell these stories about awe and wonder. They say, oh, I was just filled, and it's kind of rapturous and rhapsodic. But there's an element here that cannot be overlooked. And you, from what I've read, getting to know you and watching what you have online and in your newsletter, which is wonderful, you seem to be trying to negotiate this tension. And I'll give you an example. The idea that our interventions, you were just talking about being a gardener who does things to trees, or doesn't. And in that choice, when to intervene, when not to, when to chop off a limb, when to bring it down, do we leave the snag up? All of those questions, this is the bread and butter of being an ecologist. You're just going to have tension in your life.
Mm, absolutely. And sitting with that trouble is so important. Sitting with that tension and never wiping it away and dismissing it is such a critical part of being alive in the world and staying curious and learning.
Be super duper concrete here. Tell us how you go about this business of dealing with the tensions, intervening, not intervening, making your decisions. We have been to Woodlawn. We've talked about Brooklyn Bridge Park and old growth forests in BC. I want to know what other place, ecological system you're working with the most these days?
My family recently moved to a 200-year-old house in Connecticut. And we had been working on the house for 4 years, but we haven't really touched the land yet. We're just now starting to take care of the land. There's an old pasture, there's a forest, and there's a front yard. And the front yard is really big. We don't need that much lawn. So we're going to shrink it. We're going to shrink it down and just keep the lawn that we really use as a family, even for parties and frisbee and whatnot. And so for the areas that we're not using, we're going to turn those into garden beds and meadows, plant trees and shrubs. Part of me doesn't want to buy any plants. I want to see what's here. And I want to really see if, rather than imposing my will on the land, that I can just take a step back and see if I can let this land turn into what it wants to be, rather than me directing the whole thing. Maybe it can be a partnership as opposed to an imposition. And so one of the things that I did was to stop mowing in certain areas and just see what comes up. And rather than a bunch of weeds, although there were certainly weeds, a ton of fleabane bloomed. This purple, pretty aster-looking daisy flower just covered the landscape. There were violets everywhere. There was a little tiny flower called bluets, called Houstonia cerulea, that came up. And this was just me stopping mowing. I didn't have to do anything. And again, this lawn is 200 years old. It's probably been mowed for hundreds of years. And so these plants were just there waiting for a chance to grow up. And so I've really taken a very slow approach to altering the land. And I do buy some plants. I'm going to have a mountain laurel collection of various cultivars that is going to be gorgeous. It's going to be like a pink cloud in spring. But wherever I can, I want to collect seed from local forests with the help of seed collectors who know how to do it ecologically and are not harming wild populations. But I want to collect those seeds from my land, from other land, and grow those seeds, because those genetics, when you collect seed that's from your region, that means that those plants evolved there. They're tapped into local geology, hydrology, the amount of rain that that area gets. But they also have relationships with pollinators and with birds. And those relationships go back for thousands and thousands of years. Like in Connecticut, when there's a winterberry shrub and there's a bunch of birds that eat those birds have been selecting those berries for thousands and thousands of years. And the berries that taste the best, the berries that have the nutrients and the fats that the birds need to make it through the winter, those are the berries that the birds will eat the most, and then they get distributed. And so there's been this relationship between the plants where you live and the animals where you live for a very long time. And while it's amazing that you can go to a store and buy native plants, like that's incredible, when possible, I'm also really trying to support the plants that just naturally grow around me.
The story you just told about the winterberry and the relationship to the birds, that is a story that I as an adult can understand, but you could have told that story to a child and it would have been perfectly intelligible. Talk to me about this potential for the stories having some continuity across the generations.
The first native plants that I learned when I was little, the one that always comes back to me, is jewelweed. And there's jewelweeds all over the country. Beautiful annual flowers. A lot of people pull them out and they have orange or yellow flowers, and they're visited by hummingbirds and bumblebees. They're beautiful, gorgeous flowers that are underappreciated. But the thing about them that makes children and adults love them so much is that their seed pods explode when you touch them. That's their method of distribution, is that they get brushed up against and they just explode out. The seeds get distributed. That was the first plant that I showed my son when he was very little, when he was maybe 3 years old. I showed him how he could gently pinch those seed pods and they would explode in the most delightful, delightful manner. He now knows that some plants have a fun, exciting element, and he's going to look out for them through his life. And he still shows the jewelweed exploding seed pods to everybody who comes over our house. So now that my son knows the jewelweed intimately and takes it on as a responsibility to share it with everybody else who comes over and when he's at camp. I've had the opportunity to hear him sharing that with a bunch of littler children as well. And while I will always start with, you know, here's this wonderful plant, look at these beautiful flowers, et cetera, et cetera, he'll just go straight to check this out and like explode the seed pod. Like the story only takes 30 seconds.
We've put our spotlight on Rebecca McMacken in this episode. She is among the most influential horticulturists on the scene today. Toward the end of taping my conversation with her, I touched on something that led her to offer some profound comments about the nature of her work and how it can assist human life to flourish. All too often, we think about the biosphere as being separate from us, which it never is, clearly. We human beings are inextricably connected with the entire web of life. And that's kind of where I went at the end of our conversation. It's hardly a new theme for Constant Wonder, this nexus of where healing nature also helps humans to heal. I'm Marcus Smith, and you're listening to Constant Wonder.
Gardening itself is something we can do to heal ourselves. I got into horticulture as a direct result of a major tragedy in my life. And I was finishing my degree in British Columbia, and my dearest cousin died in a very, very tragic way. And I barely graduated. My whole world just fell apart. And I moved into a cabin on my dad's land and just like tried to put reality back together. And it was really tough. And I started, you know, practicing yoga. Many of the practices that I began were methods of self-care. And some of them were methods of self-destruction. I was so angry at the world once again. And so I was playing roller derby and smashing myself as hard as I could against the wall. And I was doing yoga and working on my breath. And I started gardening kind of in that same vein, where I knew that I needed to do something really hard physical labor. I needed to be outside in the sun all day, carrying trees and shoveling dirt and mulch, and also taking care of things. Gardening is also a way to get out of yourself and to think about the rest of the world. And then you can't but help but be surrounded by growth, be surrounded by beauty. And it really can pull people back from some very dark places. It certainly did it for me. And that's another reason why I'm so passionate about sharing this with other people, and why, you know, the practice of horticultural therapy really does exist. It is a fantastic way for people to help heal themselves and to heal others. And yeah, it's still doing that job for me. It's still one of the big reasons why I garden.
It kind of goes beyond healing for me in terms of it is making the whole world maximally receptive to life. In a way, it's setting the stage for things to thrive.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the type of gardening that I practice, ecological horticulture, is very specifically about, we're working with plants, we're working with flowers, we're working with trees. But one of the main goals is to use species that have these relationships with birds and butterflies and squirrels and all of the animals all around us, so that we're not just making beautiful gardens. We're trying to support the ecosystems all around us and create a healthy environment for everyone. And that might start as a sort of altruism or responsibility, or maybe even a method of being better than your neighbors. But it very often ends up that you get entangled with this work. You recognize that when you are supporting all of these organisms, that they are also supporting you. It's a way of realizing, it like wakes people up from the sort of linearity and repetition of the modern world. And you get put back into these cyclical patterns with your hands in the soil, and you're in touch with the weather and maybe the moon and the seasons in a way that we forget. You know, we forget about the real world that is out there, and this work can connect us back to that in a way that is so healing and so important for many folks.
Our sincere thanks to Rebecca McMacken for taking time to visit with us. She is lead horticulturist with the American Horticultural Society and for 11 years served as the lead horticulturist for the Brooklyn Bridge Park. You can find her online at RebeccaMcMacken.com. And you're going to find a trove of valuable resources there, including her newsletter. So again, RebeccaMcMacken.com. This episode was produced by Tenery Taylor with assistance from Lydia McElroy and Madeline Rollins. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio. I've got another podcast to recommend to you from the BYU Radio family of podcasts. It's called The Appleseed. Each episode features master storytellers sharing all kinds of stories for you and your family, folk tales, fairy tales, personal and family tales. It's ideal for road trips, bedtime, or any time you're looking for something that the whole family can enjoy together. And here's a great side effect of listening to The Appleseed. It has a nearly magical ability to conjure up a whole lot of healthy storytelling right at home, and it often prompts the sharing of precious memories as well. Be sure to catch The Appleseed wherever you get your podcasts.